Whether I'm worried about hosting or just giving that perfect gift, creating a delicious holiday for my loved ones is super important to me. From effortless holiday hostings to unforgettable gifts, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. They've always been super convenient in giving me the most high-quality steaks I could ask for, whether for myself or a loved one. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com, and for an extra $35 off, use code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM. Go to omahasteaks.com and use code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Welcome to the True Crime Never Sleeps show. As always, I'm your host, Larry Elise. Today's episode, for Cold Case Friday, we are diving into one of the most infamous murders in Norway history. Before we do that, give me your thoughts on the topic that we cover in the comment section below. With that, let's dive right in. On the 3rd of June, 1995, on a Saturday, a security guard at the Plaza Hotel in Oslo, Norway, was called to check on the guest staying in room 2805. As down at the check-in desk at reception, they were having a bit of a pickle, if you know what I mean. I'll tell you in a second. See, for some unknown reason, the guest staying in room 2805 hadn't been asked to provide a credit card when they checked in on May 31st, 3 days earlier. And you know, as you can imagine, you always need a credit card when you check in. Now the guest had originally booked a two-night stay for two people between the 31st and 2nd of June, but had visited the front desk on the day of check-in and asked to extend their stay by another two nights. They were given two new key cards as each card expired automatically when the checkout time comes. Unfortunately, the clerk extending the stay didn't realize that there was no credit card on file. Just like pretty much every hotel, high-end, low-end, or backwards motel, the Plaza Hotel usually required the customer booking the room to provide a credit card for, well, you know, obvious reasons. You know the routine. But on that particular occasion, the guest in room 2805, they weren't required to. And the reason they weren't required to provide a credit card on check-in? That's never actually been resolved. Some speculated that it was because she checked in at a busier time than usual for the front desk, but it was a simple but impactful oversight. Maybe, you know, the staff were just in a rush to check her in because it was so busy they just missed it. They should have gotten a credit card, and they forgot to. After all, at the time, no one could have possibly known that they were about to become characters in one of Norway's most enduring mystery books. Now, this oversight, no credit card, was noticed on more than one occasion by more than one person. In the mid-90s, the tech was a little behind the Alexas and Siris of today, so what they would do to try and, like, nudge the guest was the front desk would send messages to the customer using the room's television set. Eventually, the message would pop up on the TV, and you'd have to use the, you know, TV remote control to remove the message, click OK, you know, and so you're acknowledging the message. Reception sent that message several times, and the message was acknowledged by someone in the room because, as I said, reception knew that in order to remove the message from the screen, someone had to physically click OK. So there was a person in the room. They were seeing the message, please come down to reception, blah, 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 they clicked OK. It was after the third message sent by receptionist, I'm going to butcher these names, Evie Tomlinson, that the security guard, 25-year-old Espen Nance, was asked to visit the room and check if everything was okay. And I'm sure also maybe just ask them, hopefully get a credit card, maybe just remind them, hey, we, just 2 seconds. The guard went up to the room, knocked on the door, but got no answer. Now, the room had been cleaned for 2 days, thanks to the Do Not Disturb sign that was on the door, so nobody had been in this room for 2 days. Suddenly, though, The security guard standing outside the room heard a deafening bang that he assumed was a gunshot coming from inside room 2805. So he immediately took cover behind a nearby corner wall. Now, the security staff at the hotel were unarmed, so confrontation was by far the worst option, and stay put didn't seem like a great idea either. Unfortunately, the guard chose not to use his radio to call for help in order to not worry guests, not worry other staff who would be listening in case he was wrong. Maybe he misheard the noise. After all, there was every chance that the noise he heard, that big old bang, was not a gunshot. You know, how often do you hear gunshots coming from hotels in Norway? Not very often. Maybe it was just something else with an innocent explanation. Instead, he withdrew and used the elevator to go to the security office and fetch the security manager who was on duty that evening. The two of them returned to room 2805, but this time they had with them the hotel's master key. Now, that 15-minute gap between when the security guard heard the bang and when he returned? Well, during those 15 minutes, nobody was watching the room, and that is another thing which is vital to the mystery, because in that 15 minutes, did anybody come or go? Now, the master key could access any room in the hotel and was even able to bypass the door's double lock feature. As a result, it was kept in a secure vault that required multiple staff members to open it, hence why it took, you know, a good 15 minutes to return to the room. The security manager knocked on the door and announced himself, but again, received no response. Using the master key, he opened the door and entered room 2805. He was immediately hit by a strange smell, the smell of gunpowder. On the bed in the middle of the room was a young woman. She was very clearly deceased. She had a pistol in her hand and a single gunshot wound to the forehead. The security guards backed out of the room and contacted the police immediately, who responded to the hotel 30 minutes later. Taking a look around the room, the woman, who checked in as Jennifer, was deceased on the bed, still holding the gun tightly with her hand resting on her stomach. The television was still on, a pay-per-view movie had been purchased earlier in the day, but any more details on it are scarce. There were shockingly few personal items present in the room. No suitcase, no luggage at all. Jennifer, at the time of her death, was wearing pretty basic, simple makeup, including eyeliner, yet no makeup or cosmetics bag was found anywhere in the room. On the table near the body was an almost empty bottle of men's cologne and three soda bottles. On a separate countertop was the half-eaten last meal ordered by room service the previous evening on the Friday. The meal had actually been delivered to the wrong room first, going to room 2804, but the mistake was corrected and the meal delivered to 2805. Elsewhere in the room was a USA Today newspaper, a complimentary copy of which was included for every guest. Big fans of USA Today, apparently. The issue in Jennifer's room, though, it wasn't from hers. It was from a separate room, 2816, across the hotel from 2805. Now, frustrating, there is zero information on who was staying in that room or why Jennifer would take a newspaper from another room when, you know, an issue was provided to her for free anyways.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
And both of room 2805's key cards were also still in the room. There was also something much more obviously not present. That is, I'm going to butcher this. It's either Lois or Lewis Farragate, the second person registered, staying in the room. In fact, there was very little evidence outside of the lone men's cologne bottle that anyone else was ever with Jennifer. But it was weird. Jennifer was a woman, her second guest, Lois, another woman, Why was there men's cologne? The gunshot heard by the guard, which was assumed, in quotation marks there, because that'll come back in, was assumed to be the killed shot. But it wasn't the only one. The gun had also been fired earlier, despite no one reporting, you know, hearing it or anything like that. So in addition to the fatal shot, which we can assume killed Jennifer, a second shot had been fired into the pillow on the bed. Both bullet casings were found on the floor, and both slugs were found having passed through the bed and ended up on the floor beneath the bed. Now the first shot, which was the one that went through the pillow, was labeled as a test shot by police. That's what they would say. Which isn't as uncommon as you would think in what this was appearing to be, a suicide case. Most people who are going to end their own lives via gun will fire a test shot. But then most also don't take place in public places like hotels and have no one hear them. That was weird that nobody heard that. Having taken place in a locked room, the police almost instantly ruled the death as being a suicide. Now the locked room is another angle. It's a hotel. Most hotel room doors, they lock automatically. So someone could have left, but there was no evidence anybody else had been there. But in the years since, the mistake, calling, you know, the death a suicide, has proven pivotal in the lack of resolution to the case. No evidence was collected, and nothing was preserved. Even the security cameras were not checked. Regardless of everything else, that does seem like negligence. Like, come on, guys. Only a cursory autopsy was performed, and they didn't even check for any signs of sexual activity or assault. The body was stored for a year, but after no one came to collect it, she was given a basic burial, without even a headstone to mark where she remained. What little evidence had been kept from the scene was permanently destroyed. The unidentified woman had checked in on May 31st, 1995 at 10:44 p.m. under the name Jennifer Farragut. The booking was for two people, with the second guest listed as Lois Farragut. So Jennifer was given the original pair of key cards to room 2805. That woman, Jennifer, who spoke fluent English and German during her interactions with hotel staff, gave her home address as being 0748 Rue Day in the Belgian town of Verlaine, as well as listed her employer as Serves, also in Belgium. The date of birth on her check-in form was August 23rd, 1973, which would have made her 21, almost 22 at the time of her death. No passport number was provided, despite the receptionist ticking the box, meaning it was a required field. Investigators obviously went straight to her check-in information in order to try and identify her, but they would find that none of it was true. There was no registered company called Serves, the street in the tiny town of Verlaine on which she claimed to live, and less than 200 houses. There was no 0748 Rue Day. The phone number she had given went nowhere. It appeared by, well, everything she had left, that Jennifer Farragut didn't exist. She was a ghost. Not only could investigators not trace the name anywhere, but the woman using it had herself, on two different occasions, misspelled her own surname, using F-E-I-R-Gate rather than Farragut. Or so she spelled her surname, either Farragut or F-E-I-R-Gate, not knowing how to spell your own name. Usually that would ring alarm bells somewhere. Then again, people check into hotels using false names all the time. And it's not an issue. And the customer's real name is between the front desk and their credit card. But, as you'll remember, the police didn't have a credit card to fall back on. So much for a quick identification. When the details their Jane Doe had provided to the front desk resulted in a dead end, the next normal step for investigators would be to check the body and the room for ID. But not only did she not have any forms of identification, including a passport, which is bizarre in itself, she didn't have much else either. I don't have to tell you how strange it is for someone to check in at a hotel without a passport. Apart from a pair of short pajama bottoms and a pair of tights that she was found in, there were no other bottoms found in the room. Several blouses, but no skirts or pants. Likewise for shoes, other than the pair of black pumps Jennifer was wearing at the time of her death. See, that was something of a surprise to the cleaners at the hotel, who had been in room 2805 on June 1st, the day after check-in. The cleaners who had been in there had seen a very different pair of shoes to the one Jennifer was found in. The cleaner made a specific note of them at the time because they were a particularly stylish and expensive pair of designer shoes. The clothes that were found further suggested that whoever the woman really was, she had made deliberate choices not to be identified herself. See, each of the tops, the blouses that were in the room, had their tags and labels removed, which you don't need me to tell you, is something very common among two selected groups of people, spies and contract killers, with some obvious crossover between the two groups. Now, sometimes people also just remove the tags because they find them annoying, you know? They don't like them bothering them under the skin. But it wasn't anything in particular. It was like all these different things were adding on top of each other. One item of clothing, a jacket from a German designer, René Lazard, did not have its label removed. As well, likely though, that would have been because, you know, the label had been taken off. The jacket was one of those jackets, you know, designer things where if you remove a label, you destroy the jacket. It would like rip the lining. But the cleaner also reported that when they entered the room previously, a couple of days previous, no guests were present. That meant she would have had to leave the room somewhere between 8:35 a.m. and 12:44 p.m. when the cleaner was there. But the key card to the door was not used again until 8:50 a.m. the next day. So Jennifer must have been away overnight. So she arrives at the hotel on May 31st, checks in, which is a Wednesday. Then on Thursday, the cleaner comes to the room. She's not there. And she's not there Thursday night either. She comes back, though, on Friday, stays in the room, puts on a Do Not Disturb sign on the room, and then on Saturday, she was found dead. So where had Jennifer gone on Thursday night? Her shoes were there. Jennifer wasn't there. She comes back then the following morning, doesn't seem to leave the room again, but now the shoes are missing. So if she hadn't left the room, where did the shoes go? Regardless, Jennifer returned on the Friday. She extended her stay in the hotel for another two nights, put a Do Not Disturb sign on the door. That Friday evening, Jennifer ordered room service, and the meal, bratwurst and potato, was delivered to the room at 8:23 p.m. The employee who delivered it said that Jennifer answered the door wearing what they thought was something like a flight attendant's uniform, and she had a rolling suitcase with her, the type used by a flight crew. No sign of a uniform or the suitcase were found. Weird, somehow also disappeared. And then Jennifer was found dead the next day. The meal, though, that the room attendant had delivered, that was still in the room when her body was discovered. And it had been half eaten, the other half being found undigested in the woman's stomach during the autopsy. That means that Jennifer died within a very short window of time eating it, likely less than an hour. So had room service delivered the meal on a Friday night, Jennifer ate it and died on the Friday? Or had the room service, you know, been delivered on the Friday evening, Jennifer didn't eat it until the Saturday, and then died? As you can see here, the timing is starting to make less and less sense. Jennifer also stood out to the hotel employees because of the surprisingly large tip she gave. It was more than five times what would normally be expected at 50 kroner. Now, the gun used, which at the time was still believed to be the suicide gun, was mostly an FN Browning HP, high-powered semi-automatic pistol, but it had been modified with parts from other manufacturers. Its serial number had been removed, which isn't uncommon at all in the criminal underworld, but what was unusual, though, was how it had been done. Usually it'd be scratched off or sanded off, which leaves a readable but very, you know, deep impression of the digits, and it's very noticeable when a serial number has been removed. Except in this case, whoever removed the Browning serial number had done a professional job, using acid to completely burn the number off. There were seven rounds still in the firearm's magazine. Also, the gun may have been in her hand, but when it was analyzed, no fingerprints, including Jennifer's, were found anywhere on the pistol. Apart from a very awkward position of the gun in Jennifer's hand, and the fact that it was so neatly resting on her stomach, there was something even more strange about it. When the police had finished taking photographs of the scene, they began to examine the body more closely. An officer noted that just as he moved the hand holding the gun, you know, in order to properly secure the firearm and make it safe before logging it into evidence, both he and another officer heard a very distinctive metal-on-metal click. Now, that may sound so small, right, that these officers, when they moved the gun, they heard a click, but it's a very important detail, so bear with me. To explain why it's a very important detail that they heard that click, we have to get into the weeds a little and talk about the way a semi-automatic pistol like the Browning works. So I'll try to keep this explanation simple and keep this straightforward. I know some of you listening know firearms better than I ever will, and I'm sure others of you listening, you just don't care. but it's basically a testament to the engineering genius of people like John Browning and Samuel Colt, and how insanely well-designed the mechanics of a semi-automatic pistol are. They're barely changed in over 100 years in some cases. So when a semi-pistol is fired, right, the explosion of the gunpowder pushes the slug out of the barrel at force, but the expansion of gases also pushes the slide back, which is the top part that catches on the rim of the fired shell, and pulls the case back to the open chamber. That allows the gas to eject the case from the gun. That's the first stage. Bearing in mind that this all takes place in a fraction of a second, so the slide moving backward also compresses a spring, usually round barrel. Which then expands once the gas is vented and the pressure releases. As the slide resets, you know, forward, back into position, it catches on the rear of the next round, which is moved to the top of the magazine by a spring. As it catches, it moves around forward and into the chamber, which is a solid block at the beginning of the barrel, and it's then ready to be fired. Basically, that's how a handgun, semi-automatic handgun like this, works in slow motion. The semi-automatic auto action means that the trigger needs to be pulled to fire a round, but as soon as the trigger resets, another round can be fired. Clack, clack, clack. You're pulling the trigger backward and then releasing it, then you pull it again. So the reset happens after the second stage is completed, and normally you would release the pressure on the trigger at the same time, so you wouldn't notice the sound it makes, which is a metal-on-metal click, but that's the sound the officers heard. So that sounds simple and kind of dumb, but it meant that Jennifer's thumb, which had been on the trigger when the gun, you know, was fired, her thumb hadn't been moved. It had been holding down the trigger even after she was dead, stopping the trigger from going back, forward, and resetting. So while that would point to a suicide, her thumb pushing down on the trigger and then her dying, this becomes an issue when the gun was so neatly in Jennifer's hand. And you know why it was so suspicious? So though the 9mm is usually considered a smaller caliber, the FN Browning, it's a big, powerful handgun. It was literally an FN Browning HP, high power. Jennifer was a 5'2", slightly built woman, not to mention that when a person dies, they usually go limp before rigor mortis sets in, which takes some time. From what I've read online, the force to pull the trigger or hold it down as Jennifer would have been in her case is 4.5 pounds. So it doesn't make sense that she would be holding the gun so neatly in her hand after she had shot herself in the head, and then she would still be holding it down so tightly with her thumb. And just from the way it was resting on her chest in her hand, it didn't seem to make sense. There's simply not much reason that a tiny woman would be able to hold the pistol so securely and even retain a grip on it after death. So putting two and two together in my mind, that all means that someone had to have been holding the pistol in Jennifer's hand and held it to her head, squeezed the trigger, then lowered it down to rest on her body. So again, right folks, I know we're getting in the weeds a little bit here. Any of those things in isolation could have been written off as an oddity. But you know, the timeline, she disappears for one night, then reappears. Where had she gone that night? Items from the room appeared and disappeared, but it didn't seem like she was leaving. It didn't seem like she was coming and going. Expensive, fancy designer shoes, flight attendant's uniform, flight crew rolling case. They weren't found in the room, so had someone come, collected them, and left? Food had been delivered to her room on the Friday night. She was believed to be dead on the Saturday. But food was found undigested in her stomach, so had she been killed on the Friday night? Or had she had food delivered, chosen not to eat it till the next day, and then she died? All of these things, you know, they just add up and add up. When all taken together, it starts to look a lot more like tradecraft, or what I would call some serious BS. So when the pistol was checked, there were still 7 unfired rounds in the magazine, coupled with a briefcase containing another 25 rounds. Again, this all starts to look a little bit strange. After all, I'm pretty sure people don't usually think, oh, you know, I might need to shoot myself 33 times. And of course, I gotta take a test shot too. Better take 34 rounds with me, just in case I miss. The hotel was far from a cheap backwater hole. At the time, the 37-story, 678 Oslo Plaza Hotel, which is now today the Radisson Blu Plaza Hotel, had only completed construction 6 years earlier and was considered at the cutting edge of luxury five-star accommodations. Obviously, that meant it wasn't cheap, with the room Jennifer Farragut was allocated, 2805, being 1,845 Norwegian kroner per night, which roughly works out at about $300 a night in today's money. The hotel, being an expensive stay, could point in two directions. Well, I suppose it could point in any direction you want. Did Jennifer manage to wrangle herself a stay at the super-duper fancy hotel in order to live out her last few days in glory? You know, she wanted to go out on high. Or was she there for some other reason and perhaps intercepted by an enemy or burned by her friends? Had somebody followed her there and murdered her? The hotel, being in a historically neutral country like Norway and being a luxury spot in a central city, well, that had just been one of the locations to host peace talks between Israel and Palestine a few years previous. Now, of course, I'm not saying Jennifer had anything to do with those particular states or anything like that, but it just goes to show that a site like the hotel would have been a prime target for international espionage. You know, it was a place for world politics, and a lot of shit can go down during those world politics events. Was she there to scout the hotel for a future operation? There's a million clandestine reasons, you know, she could have been there and murdered if she was murdered. Like, I'm sure all of you guys remember, right, how the Golden State Killer was finally caught and convicted of committing 13 murders? It was all after his DNA was entered into a variety of genealogical databases, and investigators were able to trace him through his relatives. So I hear you, Bar Big Dog. You know, I'm sure one of you guys is thinking, why don't they check the DNA? Check this mysterious Jennifer Farragut's DNA. Whack it into one of those family tree sites, you know, Ancestry.com. Well, my friends, while that would be great, it would be fantastic, it would likely lead to at least a partial answer. There is a bit of an issue with that. That issue is Norway's very strict laws on what a person's DNA can be used for. See, in Norway, there are extremely tight protections on using DNA in such a way. Basically, without the express consent of the person in question or victim. In this case, the authorities are very limited in what they can use DNA for. Now, that's not to say investigators, though, haven't been able to do anything DNA-wise to try and find out who she was. In 2016, Jennifer's remains were actually exhumed in order for samples to be taken. Standard samples, blood, etc. had been taken at the time of her death back in 95 and during her autopsy, but all had been destroyed in 96 after no one, you know, claimed the body and it was basically ruled suicide. The exhumation allowed new samples to be taken using the pulp from Jennifer's teeth. These teeth, by the way, had actually already indicated to authorities that their suspicion that Jennifer, likely being from Germany or nearby, was probably accurate. Her teeth were in good condition, and she had fairly expensive dental work, which used gold fillings and was typical of Germany at the time. Now, though, using modern techniques, authorities were able to gain even more evidence pointing to Jennifer being German. They were using now isotope testing, while isotope testing is not 100% accurate, it can give a very good base to work from. It's a technique primarily used by archaeologists and anthropologists in tracing the movements and migrations of basically human beings throughout history. You can trace human beings migrating, you know, out of Africa and going somewhere to Europe, somewhere blah, 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 blah. Though in criminal cases, it can be very helpful in pointing where a human has lived for extended periods. Like, it's not going to tell you that Mr. and Mrs. Jim Bob went camping in Spain for 2 weeks in 2018, but it can tell you some fascinating, accurate things, like this subject spent at least a decade in Eastern Croatia, or some quite specific things like what the individual's diet was like. See, isotope testing, basically how it works is, it all rests on your human bones being continuously updated and upgraded throughout your life. Everything that person ingests goes towards building up their physical body, and it all carries the unique signature of their own specific geographical origin. You're literally basically taking you apart. You're a map of where you have been. It's almost like a very advanced version of counting the rings in a tree trunk to determine its age. Only you don't need to be sawn in half. I mean, you can be, but yeah, it's not a requirement. So that was all a very long way of getting to the findings of the isotope testing on Jennifer's remains. So it turns out that just like her address, her name, her phone number, her place of work, her date of birth, and her age were also wrong. Rather than the 21 claimed on the check-in form, Jennifer was actually a couple years older. She was around 24 years of age. She had Eastern European heritage and had lived in East Germany until at least the age of 16. It's not a lot, but it's something. Had she been an East German spy? Well, she probably would have been a bit young to be an East German spy, but you never know, right? In addition to the DNA testing, the original sketch artist created new sketches of Jennifer from police photographs of the scene, and these were published in VG, which is a Norwegian paper, and other newspapers. They were also sent out to various authorities to try and get an identification. And there weren't exactly zero suspects, though none with an actual identity. One possibility implicates the man in the room directly next door, a Belgian man identified as Mr. F. So in addition to this man next door saying he heard nothing, including the gunshots that night, and we know there were at least two gunshots fired in the room. The man also allegedly said he heard about Jennifer's death when he checked out on Saturday morning. But she didn't die until Saturday evening. If you know the gunshot was correct, the second gunshot was her kill shot. So was Jennifer actually killed on Friday night? Remember, that was the night she ordered room service and still had undigested food in her stomach when she was found the next day. There are so many questions left hanging and so many possibilities in this case, it's hard to get a grasp on what it really was all about. I mean, I think the main one for me is this. Why so many things about the death of the woman in room 2805? They seem so professional and organized, while other things seem so sloppy. Putting together some of the more interesting theories I came across while researching Jennifer's case, that leads me to a possible reason why there was a suitcase with bullets, but there was no luggage or suitcase with pants or skirts or her flight uniform, which you know she was wearing, her expensive designer shoes, flight attendant's uniform, all these things that were seen in the room, but were never found in the room. The theory goes that Jennifer was packing her suitcase and had packed, you know, all of her clothing, her makeup, which was never found, all the missing things you would have expected to find, only she was killed before she could finish packing her stuff. But then the killer made a mistake. In this case, the killer had murdered her on Friday night. Then on Saturday, the security guard came to the door, tried to get in. The killer is still in the room, and they fired a second shot into the pillow using the gun already placed in Jennifer's hand. But his hands were over Jennifer's, which stopped her from getting the expected amount of gunshot residue and blood on them. And it also held the trigger back. So this gunshot then scares off the security guard so the killer could leave, but they made a mistake. When they went to leave, instead of taking the case with the ammunition in it, they took the wrong suitcase. They took the suitcase with all the clothes. It's again a possibility, but it still doesn't answer a million other questions, like, why was she there in the first place? Was there a killer? This is like a batshit insane case, I'm not gonna lie. But I've got to say, it's very likely that no one would even be aware of Jennifer's case if it wasn't for the journalist Lars Christian Wegner, who has doggedly investigated it for more than 20 years. Beginning with a fantastic article in VG, it was Lars who persuaded the assistant chief of police in 2015 to exhume Jennifer and obtain the DNA for testing. It was his work that led to the case being presented in an episode of the rebooted Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix. Jennifer's case, though, is, of course, it's not the only mysterious death of an unidentified young woman to be ruled as a suicide, but with major questions. A much more famous case, which is sort of similar to this, is the Isdal woman, which I believe I've covered in this podcast or another. That case has long been a favorite in the true crime world. It also has some scary and eerie similarities to Jennifer. The long and short of the Isdal woman case, an unidentified woman who was found dead in Norway back in 1970. At the time, it was ruled a suicide, but over the years, people seemed to think that there was more and more going on. This woman, though, she wasn't found in a hotel. She was found in a well, a place nicknamed Death Valley, a place with a history of suicides and hiking accidents. It was two hikers who just came across the charred body of a woman, located among some rocks and stuff like that. She was found near a burnt-out campfire where lots of items lay around her, and all identifying marks and labels on her items have been removed, scrubbed off, or removed. So it was, again, very strange. It was like somebody purposely didn't want the victim identified. Then, after someone's body was found a couple days later, police found suitcases which they believe belonged to the woman at a train station. You know, not terribly far away. She was found in a remote valley, but this was in the closest train station. Inside the suitcases were money in lots of different denomination. Wigs, shoes, clothing, maps, timetables. Basically, a lot of it seemed like, you know, she was a spy. Very strange. But you know, so much time passed between the Isdal woman and Jennifer Fairgate, it's unlikely that, you know, these two are related. But there you go. That is the story of Jennifer Fairgate. Very, very strange and unsolved case. When was she killed? We don't even know. Who killed her? Did she do it herself? I mean, today, it could be the most simplest explanation is the likeliest. It was a suicide. And all these other things are red herrings, you know, right? We just don't know. But let me know your thoughts on this case, as always. And let me know what you're thinking about this old one, all right? And I'll leave it there. Of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We will see you on our next episode.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.